Bienvenidos to our latest edition of Corazón Bilingüe. Join us as we explore the dynamics of language, culture, and the art of poetry. I'm your host, Brenda Nettles Rojas. Con este programa, exploramos la dinámica del lenguaje, la cultura, y la creación poética, sometimes in English y a veces en español. Our program fluctuates between English and Spanish.
We are here today with educator, writer, and editor Sarah Cortez. Sarah is a member of the Texas Institute of Letters. She was inducted in 2012 and is a winner of the Penn Texas Literary Award in Poetry. Sarah is joining us today via a telephone interview from Houston, Texas. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sarah.
Brenda, I'm thrilled to be with you.
Well, Sarah, I know you're getting ready for a book expo in New York City.
Yes. My co-editor and I, Sergio Troncoso, will be signing copies of the latest book, which I edited, called Our Lost Border, Essays on Life Amid the Narco Violence. Sergio is my co-editor. We'll be signing copies at BEA, Book Expo America.
Tell me a little bit about the book.
Well, the book came out of both, I shouldn't speak for my co-editor, I guess I'll speak out of for myself. It came out of the desire to help people understand not only sort of the ferocity of the ongoing violence by the drug cartels, both in Mexico and on the U.S.-Mexican border, but also to honor the binational, bicultural existence of a thriving, interesting, beautiful, energetic culture that's existed along that border for decades.
Right.
But now, which unfortunately is pretty much gone because of the cartels.
Mm, yeah. Is there a favorite essay in the book?
Well, you know, the book incorporates many different styles of essay. I would say my favorite style is the lyric essay, and that's a lyric essay by Jose Antonio Rodriguez.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many different tones and styles because we wanted people not to write, we asked contributors not to write academic essays because those are pretty boring, you know, frankly. The only other people that read them are other academics.
Right, they have their place.
They have their place, and I'm in no way, you know, not honoring those academics we have amongst us, but our initial vision was to create a book which would help anyone who wanted to appreciate and learn about the situation in a human fashion. We were seeking to honor the human moments of everyday life of people along the border and how those have been changed. We specifically wanted to know how life and culture have been changed by the tragedy of the ongoing violence and Mexico's inability to stop it.
Mm, interesting. Now, I must say, Sarah, you work in so many different genres. Let's take it back a little bit to what brought you to writing.
Oh, gosh. You know, that's such a rich topic and fun topic for me, Brenda, because one of my earliest dreams, childhood dreams when I was still sort of just not too far beyond working on my ABCs and forming words, one of my earliest dreams was to become a writer. And I put off that dream, age 12 or so, age 13, I put off that dream because I realized I wanted to be able to earn a living in life.
Right.
And sometimes even people who become famous writers after their death, during their lives, don't do such a hot job of earning a living. So I got practical at an early age, but in my late 30s, I started taking writing courses, and my sort of sojourn with writing has been long and very fruitful. I started out as a literary fiction writer in the late 80s. I sort of segued into literary poetry. My first book, solo book published, was in literary poetry. I became very interested in memoir. My first memoir came out last September with Texas Review Press.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm very proud of that book. Texas Review Press is the most prestigious literary press in Texas. You know, I'm just sort of thrilled.
Absolutely.
In the meantime, I took some segues into crime writing. I both edit and I edit in all genres, but I've produced three anthologies of crime fiction, which I edited. So, you know, and I write it all. I've written prayers. I've written academic work. I've written chapters in textbooks. I write a lot of personal essay and sort of a lot of poetry still. And love it all.
Is there a genre that you are particularly fond of or that keeps pulling you back?
I think that would be poetry. I am so much a devotee of the concise line and the resonant image. It's nothing for me to work six or seven years on a poem, not continuously,
right.
But, you know, off and on, to really hone it and really, you know, apply the pressure of, you know, breath and resonant image and the unfolding, you know, because your unfolding is so different than the unfolding of narrative,
right,
and literary fiction. And so, yeah, poetry just keeps pulling me back.
Well, it's amazing how we can continue to tweak something. And even, I don't know if you find that when you're reading something that's already been published, you tweak it when you read it.
Not in my own work. I think one of the hardest things, I teach a lot of writing classes and workshops, and I think one of the hardest things for writers, one of the questions I get asked most often by writers is, how do you know when it's finished? And my reply is always, when it's perfect. And then they go, well, how do you know when it's perfect? And I say, well, you develop the judgment. I mean, it's judgment you have to develop by reading other excellent writers, but you read them not as a reader. You read other writers as a writer, and you look at the decisions, and you question them, and you think about them. I think it probably takes most people years and years, if not decades, to hone their judgment so that they become good enough to edit their own work.
Right.
And know when to stop editing their own work.
Right, and that's certainly an important component to writing, is that judgment, making that judgment call.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Sarah, we would love to hear one of your poems today.
Okay, I would like to read you the title poem from Walking Home, Growing Up Hispanic in Houston, the memoir which came out last fall.
And this memoir is a collection of poems.
Well, it's both prose and poetry.
Oh, okay.
The first, about half of the book, are prose sections. Those prose sections document the unlived dreams of myself and my parents. When I wrote this book, I had been reading and thinking about and teaching memoir for a few years, and I felt that everybody's life has an unconscious element, and that unconscious element is the realm. I mean, it's the realm of many things, including neuroses, but ignoring those, it's the realm of the dream, and it's the realm of unfulfilled desires and unfulfilled dreams.
Mm.
And so I wrote in prose the unfulfilled dreams of myself and my parents in the first section, and then the second half of the book and the poem, I wrote what we did, what actually happened.
That's an interesting way to approach it.
Yeah, you know, the more I thought about it, Brenda, the more I thought, you know, we as human beings are not only the result of what we do, our activities and choices, but we're also the result of what we don't do.
Mm.
You know, for instance, a mother may, like my mother, one of the dreams I wrote was her dream to have many, many, many children. She loved babies, she loved small children, she wanted to have a whole bunch of them, and for whatever, you know, medical reasons, that was not feasible for her. So if you look at her life, you're only going to see me, her only child. But if you look in her heart, you see all those other children she never had and whatever she felt about that.
What a fascinating approach to memoir.
Yeah, thank you. I've received wonderful, wonderful reviews and comments from readers on this book. It's a very Catholic book. I don't mind saying that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because I grew up in the Catholic faith, and there's a spiritual dimension to the book, and it's a joy-filled dimension. So I get wonderful comments on this book from, you know, people who are Jewish, Protestant, and who are yoga practitioners and Buddhist and whatever, because they relate to the joy of belief.
Right. Well, and if you're going to be true to memoir, you're going to be true to your faith and your upbringing.
Right, which I think you should. I mean, it's not so fashionable anymore, but, you know, I for one don't care about that. So, okay, let me read you the poem. You've been very patient, so thank you.
Oh, no, I've been enjoying the conversation.
Okay. Walking home. I know who and what will be there when I arrive. Mom chopping for dinner. Attic fan cooling. Small white dog, tail furled, barking. Daddy will come home. At dinner, I'll drink two glasses of ice-cold milk. We'll talk. revive the memory, its nearness. Walk yourself home, then back here again.
Wow, I can definitely see that unfolding with that poem.
Oh, good.
Absolutely, in the imagery. And you don't really expect where it's taking you.
That poem was, I can't tell you how hard it was to write because I was so stumped. And at first I wanted it to be the first poem in the book, you know, like the title poem. And I sort of left it that way for several years of revision. And then one day, I don't know, out of the blue, it hit me as like, this isn't the first poem. This has to be the final poem. And indeed it is.
Well, Sarah, I'm prompted to ask you to read us another one. I enjoyed that one so much.
Oh, thank you so much. Let me page through the book here real quick and find one. I'll read you a poem entitled Zugeen. This poem actually won an honorable mention in a poetry prize a few years back. And we'll see what you think about this, Brenda.
Okay.
This is a poem about a house in my neighborhood in Houston. Growing up, Seguin. What did she do in long summer afternoons, standing inside the small square window, three houses over from our house? Her son, faint and washed out in my memory, except for stiff, blonde crew cut, a small boy's thin shoulders, tanned knees and elbows. Their house, a white wood shingle with no front sidewalk. No husband we knew of in our church or at the nearby grocery. Somehow, I heard she was from Seguin, a place I didn't know, a place I forever linked with a thin woman's tall shadow in a house I never entered. The flat plain of empty, the troubled call for home, a starched white blouse behind a high screened window over an empty kitchen sink.
Wow, it's amazing how you can connect us to a place that you haven't really been to.
Yeah, I mean, in fact...
And to a life.
Although I drive by it often between, I drive by the cutoff to Seguin often between East and San Antonio. But, you know, when you're a kid, especially in that era before globalization and so forth, in a small, you know, we were this beautiful little pristine small neighborhood in middle class Houston. And, you know, just hearing that about that woman, that place just took on all these properties for me, especially because their household was so different from all the rest.
Right. And I find it curious how it drew you in, that curiosity about the other.
Mm-hmm. And again, when I started writing that particular poem, the memoir only goes up to about age 18, so I had a very, you know, specific sort of set of years that I was looking to find very resonant, sort of haunting things to write about in the poems. When I started making the list, you know, that just came, sort of floated up from the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in writing classes, I'm often, because I teach advanced poetry, another class in memoir, and then another class, it sort of floats, that third class, some semesters it's spiritual essay, some semesters it's a lyric essay. But I tell all my classes, when you get those gifts from the unconscious that just float up, like an image or a word or a phrase, write them down. They're such gifts. You know, they're there for you as a writer, and if you don't write them down, you just lose them.
Right, absolutely. Now, Sarah, how do you pick, I mean, working with so many different genres, how do you decide this is the story that's going to be told in this genre?
I would say, and this might be a little controversial, but I would say that after all these years of writing and so forth, teaching, I believe each story has a specific genre that's showing off the best.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we as writers work try to get more attuned to not only what our own stories are inside of us and what's appropriate to share ethically, what's not appropriate, and so forth, but how to bring it forth in a particular genre, how to have the skills and the genre that that piece is calling us to be written in.
Right.
And I just salute. I mean, I have many wonderful students, and I work with many wonderful other writers as, you know, editing manuscripts freelance. But I just so honor the dedication and the commitment and hard work that I see so many writers are willing to put into acquiring the skills, the craft skills. I mean, those are basic. You got to get those down. But also hearing the voices inside that are calling to each one of us for what right.
Right.
And going back to your very important question, how to find the genre that it needs to be written in. And for me, my definition for professional writer, for me alone, is that I need to be able to do this in all these different genres. And in fact, I mean, I write literary fiction, but I love writing fiction for young adults, too. I mean, that's just one of my passions, because we as Hispanics have to be creating a younger generation that can read and write English.
Absolutely.
So basic, and having a good life in the U.S. But anyway, I love it all. There aren't enough hours in the day. What can I say?
Now, I read somewhere, and correct me if I'm wrong, is your background in police work, or do you have some background in police work?
Yes, I've been a police officer for 19 years.
Wow, because I noticed that you've written some mystery stories, and I was wondering if there's a connection to your police work and the mystery pieces.
Yeah, actually, the mystery stories are not, because believe me, most of what happens in police work is boring and dirty. It's not the stuff that, you know, Hollywood would make you believe, or any of these crime novels would make you believe, but I have a firm commitment to law enforcement, and I went into law enforcement after a 14-year corporate career, and, you know, I think becoming a cop is the best thing I've ever done.
Uh-huh.
I love police work, mm-hmm. and I love standing up for what I believe.
Right, and it seems like you do that in your writing as well. You stand up for what you believe in your writing.
Well, I try. You know, that's a risky thing to do in today's America, unfortunately, but, you know, I think I try not to be polemic, because once you start into the world of ideas, it's very easy for other people to disagree. But when you show the humanness of whatever it is you're trying to show the humanness of, I mean, I did some training recently for cops on human trafficking, and, you know, to show the human side of these horrible, 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 mind-boggling, primitive conditions that these poor women are kept in, and the women are mostly Asian. You know, to show that human side, there's nobody who can disagree with that. They might disagree with an idea about it, but they can't disagree with that human experience.
Right.
And that's why I, even in my poetry about policing, and I have a book coming out, the thought poetry on police work and fire service work this summer. But if you show the human side, I like to create bridges. I like to create bridges of understanding between groups that do not ordinarily understand each other. And nobody understands cops except cops. You know, are people married to them? And nobody likes them except the people that are married to them and other cops. So I like trying to help create bridges of understanding between civilians and police.
Let's talk a little bit now about editing, because I know that you edit manuscripts and are a freelance editor as well. Let's talk a little bit about that editing process.
Okay. One of my greatest joys is working with other writers, and I work with writers of all ages. In fact, my youngest client right now is 12, and probably my more senior client is in the mid-80s.
That is quite a variety.
Yeah, I love it. I just love it. And I do everything from speculative fiction to literary work. I do sometimes people contact me to look at entire manuscripts, especially if, you know, they're not sure does the manuscript unfold in the correct order? Have I fulfilled the elements of the genre, like in fiction, you know, plot, characterization, tone, pacing, so forth? And so I do a lot of that, and obviously I have to do it for the anthologies I edit, but when I do it for the anthologies I edit, it's a publisher who pays me, because for each anthology, I conceptualize the idea. Let's say for the one Sergio and I, we conceptualize that idea together. I conceptualize the idea. I write a book proposal. I make sure it's a book that has never been done before, because that's the type of anthology I like doing. Mm-hmm. I believe in. And then I go to the editor and sell the project, and the publisher and sell the project, and then the publisher pays me to give him the project that is in the book proposal.
Interesting. And I'm sure that this process really helps in your own writing, editing.
It does. I think one of the things that's most helpful is, I have three wonderful, wonderful publishers who I admire greatly. And because I've been in the industry a long time, I know their side of it. I know the agent side of it. I'm not an agent myself, but I understand what the agent does and must do and tries to do. And then, obviously, I've been a working writer for many, many years, 20 years or so. And then I've been teaching writing. And then, I built my writing career. I don't have an MFA in writing. I built my writing career day in and day out, most of the time in the corporate world with a very demanding job. So I think I can appreciate all sides of it. I mean, a lot of the writers I see, especially newer writers, of whatever age, they come in and they think they're hotshot, and they start demanding the publisher do this and demanding the publisher do that, and they can't be bothered to sell their books. That's a publisher's job. And they make so many unfortunate errors in how they approach their relationship with the publishers. So, in fact, I gave a presentation a little over a week ago to a wonderful group here, Mystery Writers of America, and I put together, the 10 things. Here are the 10 secrets nobody ever writes down to having a successful writing career. So let me clue you in.
Okay.
And I chatted about it and told them about some mistakes, that I've seen in a way that was general enough they're never going to know who made the mistake. But, just please don't make these mistakes. So many people are in love with the idea of publishing a book, and that's a worthwhile, wonderful goal. But that's a very different goal than having a writing career.
Right.
And, you get to make your decisions in very different ways, depending on which you want.
Mm-hmm.
But most people don't understand that.
Wow. Sarah, there's so much that we could go into. I wish we had more time. Is there a particular writing exercise that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Yes. Here's an exercise that will keep you from ever thinking that you have writer's block.
Excellent. I could use that.
Brenda, your listeners, I'm sure you know this already. I hope your listeners will understand that writing block is a myth. It doesn't exist. People make a lot of money writing books about it. Once you read one of those books, you will have writer's block. Don't read them, okay? Because you'll get all neurotic about worrying about it. So, of course, you'll have it. Okay? So here's the thing. If you ever are stumped, you're just having a hard day getting to your writing, take a walk outside. Pick something physical, a rock, a bush, a plant, a tree, a piece of a tree, a piece of a bush, it doesn't matter. It has to be something physical, and you can pick it up, smell it, touch it, do whatever related to the five senses. Don't get polemic. Don't start having, just let yourself be physical with this physical piece of your flora and fauna. Go inside and let the physical characteristics of whatever it is appear on the page. Just start writing. Soft, fuzzy, warm, mm-hmm. wet nose, my dog, I love my dog, whatever. And from there, you will be able to enter your writing. You may or may not use that little few initial sentences or paragraphs, but if you start with something physical, you will never have writer's block.
Good idea. Excellent.
So, there we are.
Well, Sarah, it's been a real joy talking to you today. Thank you so much for joining us. I know, as we mentioned earlier, you're getting ready for your book expo in New York City. So congratulations and have a safe trip. And I hope that we can invite you back on the program to talk a little bit more, because I know that there was so much more we didn't get to.
Well, it was my honor, Brenda. Thank you so much for contacting me. And I really appreciate the invitation to be with you today.
Well, thank you again, Sarah. You are listening to Corazón Bilingüe. We invite you to join us again as we continue our conversation on language, culture, and the art of poetry. Los invitamos que nos acompañen de nuevo, mientras que sigamos explorando la dinámica del lenguaje, la cultura, y la creación poética. If you would like to hear more, visit us at www.corazonbilingüe.com. Gracias por acompañarnos.